he got put back in, not because she complained, because he was honest with his parole officer and told him that that's what, how his week had been. How's your week been? Well, I had to talk to her and blah, blah, blah. What do you mean you talked to her? Well, I had to because the kid's nut. Bang, back in jail. But in my head I go, is this better or worse than being in jail? Guess what? Most things are better.
Still better.
Yeah.
Have you ever wondered how humiliating it would be to be caught stealing by your boss? Have you ever wondered how you'd tell your parents? How you'd tell your friends you were going to jail? Or what it would feel like to have your child visit you there? Today's guest, Will, lived through all of those scenarios. Not because of any big flashy crimes that made headlines, but because a bizarre coincidence, in a moment of weakness, created an opportunity for him to alleviate the financial pressure that had been building up in his life. It's a set of circumstances I think a lot of us will relate to, and I, for one, have to admit that the course of action Will took would have at least crossed my mind too. His story is full of surprises, from bloody assaults to the kindness of strangers with Tim Tams.
This is Australian True Crime with Michelle Laurie and Emily Webb. So, Will, you contacted us and told us that you had some time in jail and for quite a serious crime, but tell us, why did you contact us wanting to talk about your experience?
I'm a bit of a true crime fan and I listen to the podcast. I put myself in a terrible situation. I stole a good whack of money from the company that I was working for. It was around $300,000 over the period of about 18 months. And my wife at the time worked for the same company, so I put her career and her lifestyle in jeopardy as well. And it was all because we got in over our heads and a moment of temptation came along, and rather than do the right thing, I took the temptation. And the problem is, once you do that once, you've broken your moral compass, and it's the reality is it's easier to do it again, and then you get used to having that little bit of extra money. And then
take us back to where your life was before, just before this all started.
Because I think a lot of us could relate to getting in over our heads financially, you know, at these points of our lives.
So I would describe it as we weren't keeping up with the Joneses, we were the Joneses. We had a beautiful house out in the eastern suburbs and we'd done a lot of renovation to it. We'd have an inheritance, and so we had started doing renovations with that. The renovations weren't finished and that had mostly been spent or invested. And we were in a situation where we had bills to finish the reno. We were starting to get behind on the mortgage, and we had a credit card debt, and, you know, we still wanted to have a nice lifestyle. And my job was with a financial institution, with an insurer, and part of my job was that if somebody had to get paid out, because our customer had hit their car sort of thing, and we sent them a check and the check came back to us because they didn't live there anymore, my job was to cancel it. And one day when I was very stressed about all of this and what situation we were in, a check came across my desk that was in my name, just randomly, because we'd sent a check out to some bloke that had the same name as me and he didn't live there anymore.
How bizarre.
And instead of doing what I should have done and cancelling it, I put it in my desk drawer and, you know, it sat there sounding, you know, it was all I could think about for 3 days.
How much was the check for?
The check was about $6,000.
Mm-hmm.
And it was enough. It was enough to pay the bills and it was enough to get us out of the current hole that we were in. And about 3 days later, I went and banked it and I didn't actually sleep that night. I thought, I've got to go back. I've got to fix this. I've got to go back into work and da, 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 da. But there were still bills.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't. And I spent it and I paid our bills. And then nothing happened, you know, 3 months later, nothing happened. And I thought, well, one more won't hurt. And that second time I actually drew a check to that same bloke, knowing that it had come back to me and that I could cash it because I knew he didn't live there. And that's sort of where it started. And then before I knew it, it was you know, once a month, and then it was once every couple of weeks. And then when work sat me down and said, we need to talk to you about these transactions, they told me, would you be surprised to know that it's $300,000? And I was stunned that it was that much money.
How did they figure it out? Does it just, is there eventually a red flag that goes up?
Yeah, there's eventually a red flag that goes up. The great thing, there's... I can find humour in a lot of this,
okay. Which
is nice. It's a nice way to cope. But my absolute best mate, who, when I called him and told him what I had done and that I had been walked out of work and I was going to be charged, he said, okay, you're an idiot. And then he rang me the next morning and said, I've organised this solicitor. You're meeting me at this time. I'm paying for it until you know what you're doing, right?
Wow.
He was the head of our... business intelligence department at that company, and he had designed the program that caught me.
There are so many coincidences already in this story. It's like, if you wrote this in a script, they'd go, well, you're just being silly. If the check would come back in your name in the first place. It is incredible. And your best mate designed the software that caught you.
Yeah. And he didn't work there by then, but he told me that later.
Oh, wow. So what happens then? You're at your desk and someone says, Will, you got 2 secs? Can you come in the office?
So the first they pulled my now ex-wife in and they questioned her as to whether she knew anything about it, and obviously she didn't. And they basically said to her, you need to go home and protect yourself now because we're going to go and get Will and we're going to have a talk to him. So they pulled me into the office and said, we need you to talk about this. We need to talk to you about these transactions. And I said, I did it. As soon as they asked me, I said, I did it. And to be honest, my first feeling was relief.
Yeah, I was going to ask that.
Because it was over.
How were you coping with the kind of stress levels that it took to do this? And even before you made that decision, what's it like?
There was an office, a meeting room in our building that you could lock. And by the end, daily, I was going in there and locking the door and laying on the floor because I just couldn't cope with all of it. Wasn't sleeping, having nightmares. You know, I was probably an awful human being to be around for my son and for my wife. But you just did. Mm. I felt like I was just walking through life numb, I guess.
Waiting.
I think a lot of people would be in that situation, just with the stresses of life. But I guess not everyone takes a decision to,
maybe not to that extent, but I think a lot of us can relate on some level to, you know, pinching a ream of paper or anything from work. Like, you know, not to oversimplify it, but I think we all have our moments where we misuse cab charges or whatever it is we're doing and we're so petrified about getting caught and how embarrassing that would be. And how embarrassing was it when you were sitting there with your bosses and they were saying to you, you've stolen $300,000 from us?
Yeah, I was shattered. I knew that I'd stolen money from them and I knew I'd done the wrong thing. I was astounded that it was that much money. Mm. And, like, after we had spoken, I had to ring my ex and tell her I did this.
She was your current at that
time,
though.
My wife at the time, yeah. And then I had to ring, because I had a company car, then I had to ring my dad and say, something's happened, you need to come into work and get me. I don't have a car here. Oh. I'll explain when you get here. And my dad is, I don't think my dad's ever misused a cab charge or taken a pen, or he's just, you know, my fiancée now and I, she laughs at me because I say to her, I just have to, how I deal with it is I think of myself like an alcoholic. Because I'm a thief, though, not an alcoholic. Mm-hmm. And it's been this many days since I've nicked something. So if I come home from work and I've got one of work's pens in my pocket, she looks at me and goes, 0 days.
Oh. I mean, had you stolen things before? Were you a little bit of a thief?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I can relate to that. I have been a bit throughout my life as well, just a sort of a – now I look at it and think, oh, I think I've just had a bit of an entitlement problem where I thought, oh, I just want that cab charge, I'm going to take it, or I just want that. Not big things, but so this had been an ongoing thing.
Yeah, I think so. I think that I've had that. I think I've got that in me, and I think I need to be really careful about. I think I've got that being willing to take the easy way out in me a little bit too.
Yeah.
So
or thinking you deserve it sometimes, like you're working hard and.
Yeah, maybe. If I look back, and I had 9 months to reflect.
Yes.
I think that probably some of it for me was. Is about taking away other people's security, which is a bit grim. But, you know, when I was young, the sort of first thing I remember stealing, for want of it, well, it was stealing, I don't know why I'm clarifying it. You know, I'd go to the newsagent and buy the Saturday Age, but instead of putting the extra in it, I'd put a Playboy in it. And I think a lot of little boys did that in my generation before the internet. But part of the thrill for me was knowing that my dad, who was an elder in the church and very well thought of in the community, had those magazines in his house and he didn't know.
So do you think then, because I've been thinking in my mind, where did your wife think the money was coming from? Were you getting some sort of little kick out of the fact that she didn't know where all the money that renos were being paid for and all that was coming from?
I don't know. I sort of haven't delved into that one as much. Maybe.
Where did she think it was all coming from? One minute you're in the hole and it's stressful, and the next minute it's okay. Where did she think it was coming from?
I think that she was happily ignorant and decided not to ask.
I think a lot of people do that. It's like, you know what, as long as stuff is running, I don't want to know what's happening. Right. And, you know, it is financial stuff is so stressful.
Yeah,
you know?
It really is. Yeah.
It can really tip you over the edge mentally and, well, obviously,
and
with your lifestyle.
The prison that I was at was full of white collar.
So how did everyone cope? How did your dad, your wife?
So my dad was okay. He just said, you'll stay here until you work out what's going on. But he wasn't. He was so mad at me. He was so angry because he's so not that person.
Yeah.
My mum was overseas, so when she came back, I was supposed to be away on holidays, and I went and knocked on her door, and she went, oh, you're not meant to be here. You're meant to be away skiing. And I said, I've done this. And she went, oh, that's what it is. Okay, well, it's nice to have you back.
She knew there was something.
Yeah, and she said, I have been asking you for a year what's wrong, and you've been saying nothing. And what did your sister say? And I said, she said exactly what you just said, which was, oh, it's going to be nice to have you back.
Wow.
Yeah, so they knew something was up, but they didn't know what it was. My wife, understandably, I think, said, I need you out of the house for a while.
Yeah.
And part of that, big part of that, was that she worked for the same company and I had put her in an incredible amount of risk.
And again, humiliation.
Yeah.
She's going into the office every day and,
And then my little fella was, I think he was 8 or 9 at the time, turning 9. So I was at my dad's. My wife brought him over. We sat down and started to have a little chat, and he goes, geez, your voice sounds funny. I'm like, oh, because I was upset. So I said to him, you know, mum and dad have had a bit of a argument and I just can't live at home for a little while and I can't tell you right now what it's about, but I will tell you, just not yet. And he went, oh, okay, can I go and play with Grandpa?
Yeah, great.
So, and when we finally had the conversation, it was very, he was amazing.
Yeah.
Did you, when did it become apparent to you that you were going to do some jail time for this?
The first day when I met with a solicitor. And he said, you're going to do some jail time.
Oh, right, okay.
He said, don't trick yourself into thinking that you'll get a suspended sentence. It's not about what you do or how much you took. It's about being consistent and showing white-collar criminals that you probably should think twice before you do it. So you will go away. My job is to reduce the amount of time.
What did you think then? Did you panic? Did you?
Yeah. I was shocked. But that was in, I think that was in the October, and I went away in the following May.
Okay, so
a bit of
time
to get ready for it. I
feel like that's a lot of time to be really scared. If that was me, oh my God, I'd be really scared about going to jail.
I did a bit of research, and amusingly, on the Corrections Victoria website, there is a page that should be called, So You're Going to Jail.
really.
Yeah, and it's got a check. It's basically got a checklist of things
what
that you need to do, and you know, make sure that you go in with a change of clothes, because at the assessment prison you're allowed to wear your own clothes. Make sure you put money in your wallet so that you've got money to put on the canteen straight away. Make sure.
Oh, okay.
You know, make sure you suspend your health insurance. That was one of the funniest moments. Oh, I went into the health insurance place,
yeah,
and sat down and said, look, I need to cancel my health insurance. And the lady, who was one of those sort of, you know, mid-50s, pinched nose,
yeah,
and why do you think that you should do something like that, right? And I leaned forward and I said, because I might be going to prison. And she sat back.
I bet.
And the look on her face, and she went, oh, I don't know what to do about that. Well, amusingly enough, there's a form, and you just tick on the form.
Going to
the
jail.
Reason why you need to suspend your thing is involuntary incarceration.
Wow.
I'm not sure what voluntary incarceration is, but involuntary, you just tick that form and you can suspend your health insurance.
Is that because you presumably...
you don't need it.
Yeah.
You've covered really, really badly by the Victorian government.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
Wow, that is one of the things – that is not something I would have thought of when I thought about things you have to do before you go.
Me either. No. So, yeah, you can suspend that. You can suspend your registration on your car. You can just tick a form to say I'm going to jail, and they suspend your registration and start it again when you come out. There's a whole bunch of stuff you can do. Yeah.
But weren't you scared of the other inmates, like, and scared of all sorts of assault and
yes.
The movies, you know, stuff that happens, Shawshank Redemption. I mean, are you scared about that for 6 months before you go?
I was thinking of watching The Good Wife, and one of the characters was facing jail, and he actually got like a consultant, an ex-jail person, who actually prepared him. It was Carey, and they prepared him. They're like, right, this is what you're going to have to do. And I was just thinking of that when you were talking.
I think my third day, I was sitting on my own in the common area of the Melbourne Assessment Prison, which is the one in the city.
Oh, yeah.
And the two guys that I knew who had been my cellmates were doing something else. So I was sitting on my own thinking, I really want to go for a walk around the yard, but I've seen every prison movie there is, and I know that going for a walk around the yard's a really foolish, you know, like it's the horror movie equivalent of opening the door into the dark and saying who's there sort
of thing. Absolutely.
And I end up, I built up the courage and went for a walk and was resolutely ignored, which I was a little bit offended by. Like, right, so I'm not a threat.
No.
And I'm not worth, you know, knocking, so.
Because that's everybody in that facility, isn't it? That's like, if you ended up later in a white-collar kind of facility, but what's it called?
The MAP, the Melbourne Assessment Prison.
I think it's where everyone goes.
Everyone's there first, so you don't know who the other guys are or what they're there for.
No, but you can tell that some of them are crims and some of them are idiots like me.
Yes, I bet.
But, yeah, so you go into the cells under the courthouse, then you go into the MAP for 2 or 3 days, then everybody goes through one of the private facilities, because then the private facilities get paid a fee for taking you for a number of days, and then you go somewhere else. So I went the MAP, Port Phillip, and then Beechworth.
So that even sounds nerve-wracking to me. You can't settle in. You're getting moved around a bit.
Yep.
Different environments, different rules, different people around you.
The rules.
What are the rules like?
Well, like at the MAP, you get locked down at 4:30 and you get unlocked at 8:30 the next morning.
Wow.
So you're in your cell for that. I mean, what's that, 16 hours?
Are you alone in there?
No. So they have – there are some what they call one out. So – they name the cells by the number of people that walk out of them in the morning. So there's one out, two out, three out.
Mm.
So mostly they're two out cells, so you're in with another person. I was in there before the government banned smoking, even though you weren't supposed to smoke, so you hoped that you weren't in with a smoker if you weren't. So, no, you're locked in with another person. And then Port Phillip's different because you don't get locked down until 8 o'clock at night. Port Phillip is terrifying. Terrifying place to be.
Why? What was so terrifying?
It's a real. That's our maximum security jail, and I was there over the June long weekend, and like that was where I saw any of the real violence that I saw, and I was only there for 4 days. And
what happened?
I saw someone stabbed over a phone.
Coming up on Australian True Crime, we find out what you should do when someone stabs someone else over a phone in jail. Will was still in the very early stages of settling into his life in the correction system when he witnessed a brutal stabbing over a phone. Luckily, he happened to be sitting right next to a bloke who knew exactly what to do next.
So I was sitting with a guy who I had... So there was two guys that I knew at Melbourne Assessment Prison that were both at Port Phillip in the same wing as me. And this guy had made me a coffee. He'd been in jail before, so he was a bit, you know, and he sat down with the coffee. And there was a guy on the phone talking, and another bloke walked up to him and just made that hand gesture of, can I use the phone next? And this bloke put the phone down and went, oh, am I allowed to swear?
Yeah.
He went, I'm talking about my fucking life here, prick.
Yeah.
Fucking back off. And the other guy just went, okay, and backed off. And then 2 minutes later, the bloke who had made the phone hand gesture came out of his room with his jacket on, and it wasn't Carl. And the dude who I was sitting with went, finish your coffee. And I said, what? He goes, finish your coffee, get back to your cell. And I said, what? And he goes, now. And as he said now, the dude in the coat just stepped forward and stabbed the bloke who was on the phone and then walked back up to his room.
Wow.
And it was just because he'd been rude to him. And so, and because of my friend, I was in my cell before the officers saw it happen, so I never saw anything.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that was how it was.
And I presume if you did see something, you didn't see anything.
Yeah, because I did see it, but I didn't see it.
What a moment. There's Will from Nice Family, from the insurance industry, who suddenly sitting in his cell.
6 days into jail.
Pretending he didn't just see someone stab someone else.
Yep.
Will found himself with a lot of time on his hands in jail, so he started writing. By the time he was released, he'd written over 40,000 words about his experience. Here, he reads us an excerpt about his first night in jail.
As an introduction to the Victorian prison system, all new inmates are issued with what's called an immediate needs pack. It contains $3 of phone credit, a packet of cigarettes, a box of matches, a toothbrush, a small tube of toothpaste, a bag containing one sachet of coffee, one of sugar and one of tea, a 600ml bottle of full cream milk and two condoms. And I walk away from this queue wondering who made the decision that my immediate needs would likely be met with one tea bag that might require two condoms. Finally, in the dark and with my arms full of prison-issued clothing and blankets, I'm escorted to my unit. A pretty blonde officer opens the door and shows me where the panic button is. She explains that I should press the button if I feel at risk from my cellmate or from myself. I think of the condoms in my pack and look my cellmate up and down. He's older than me, I guess mid-50s. He looks about as confident as I feel, and I judge it unlikely that I'll receive any advances tonight, which is just as well too because the panic button is on the bottom bunk right next to his pillow. So if I need to push it, I would have to practically snuggle up to him to do so. The officer locks us in, and I wonder how I will ever sleep without my nighttime drug Seroquel. The answer is terribly. I have a panic attack a few hours in. I realise I can't go outside, and through the milky and cracked Perspex window, I can barely even see outside. Then I realise this is my life for the next 9 months, and my chest tightens as anxiety takes its familiar grip on me. I cry as quietly as I can, and my cellmate pretends not to hear me. At one point, I get up to use the toilet. He wordlessly smiles at me and offers me a packet of Tim Tams. I gratefully accept one, and I crawl back onto my bunk. I cry until I exhaust myself, and finally I sleep.
Mm. Wow, that is very well written, by the way. Congratulations.
Oh, yeah, it is.
You're a good writer.
Thanks.
That is... really moving. Him and his Tim Tam, bless him.
Yeah, bless him.
Oh.
He was a good bloke. He was in for stealing, I think he stole $4.2 million from Patrick's.
Wow.
Yeah, he was a gambler.
Did you find, particularly among the other guys in for white-collar crimes, were there any common themes among why they committed their crimes?
A lot of it was gambling or addiction.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, a lot of it wasn't. It wasn't just me selfishly wanting a nice lifestyle.
Yeah.
There was a lot of gambling and addiction. In fact, so I've lived with depression and anxiety for a long time, and so self-centered was I when I got to Beechworth. They asked if I needed to talk to anyone, if I needed to be part of any programs, and I said, what have you got? And they said, well, we've got DNA programs. I'm like, awesome, depression and anxiety, that's me. Mm. That's drug and alcohol.
Yeah,
that's right, what DNA stands
yeah,
for.
Yeah.
Because they don't do programs for depression, they do programs for drugs.
Oh, okay.
But there's a lot of that. There's a lot of, you know, the white-collar drugs, cocaine, crack, you know, heroin, not so much heroin, but a lot of cocaine, a lot of gambling.
Mm, yeah.
So
you're in Beechworth for your 9 months.
Yep.
I mean, throughout that time, do you make friends? Do you, like, what's the go by the end of the...
You do. There's a excellent bit in Orange is the New Black that I'm certain that there's people I consult on that show that have been to jail, because it's just really... What they've got absolutely right is the relationship between the prisoners in that show.
Okay.
It's really accurate. And there's I think it's in the second season that one of the Latin girls is pregnant, and they're all sitting outside in the sun talking about how nice it'll be when she has the baby, and they're all home and all this sort of stuff. And one of the older girls says to him, we're not a family, we're a band-aid. You will go home and you will meet these people again, and you will realise the only thing you ever had in common was that you were in jail together.
Mm-hmm.
And that's absolutely true. I had firm friends in there. I had jail friends. But at the time, it doesn't feel like that. It feels like they're your friends' friends.
Yeah, but you're not looking them up now.
I have. I've been in touch. So there was probably, out of all the blokes I sort of knew, there's probably three that I looked up. One of them's disappeared. Just dropped off the radar. Another one's moved overseas, but with all three of them, I had that experience of, oh, I'm not sure quite what we've actually got in common here.
Did you guys talk about your lives and your crimes? And
yeah, we did. That rule of you don't ask each other what you did, it's all you talk about.
Yeah.
I was not unique. I was unique at Port Phillip because I was guilty. There's a lot of innocent blokes in jail.
Yes, I've heard that.
Mostly at Beechworth, they were guilty.
Mm-hmm.
So we talk about what gets you in there, but we'd also, you talk more about what you wanted to do and, you know, your family. And, you know, one guy had a family visit and his girlfriend had got pregnant, and so they were going to have the baby soon. So we'd talk about that.
She got pregnant during the family visit?
Yeah.
So you get conjugals at Beechworth?
If you've been in long enough, you do. There's a unit. There's no fences at Beechworth. The only fence is around the visitor area to stop the kids going in the car park.
Wow.
It's a farm.
Oh,
there's
yeah.
There's a sign. There's a big walking track around the outside of it, and there's a little sign at either end of the walking track that says, if you go past this sign, you're off prison ground. So don't do it, please.
Okay.
God. That's it. And just outside the prison grounds proper, there's a unit. There's a little, like you'd see one of those little units in a caravan park.
Okay.
And you get to have a weekend with your family. You get to order the food that you're going to, like the kitchen stocks the food.
Wow.
So you've got to be pretty low risk, very well behaved, or
to
nearing the end of, like, the man who did the manslaughter and the murder.
Yeah.
Why was he in? Because he was nearing, right,
yeah.
Okay, yeah.
And he'd been well behaved. And I think he'd come through, you know, he'd gone to Port Phillip and he'd gone to Darringall, which is in Shepparton, and then he'd gone to a couple of others, and then he'd ended up there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Did your family visit you?
Yeah, I would have to, yeah. Just about every second weekend, my son came up with my now ex-wife.
Mm-hmm.
She was really supportive of us continuing to have a relationship. And just about every other weekend, I had someone. And your lifeblood in prison is mail and visitors.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I remember I was in there when they changed the stamp price to $1, and they were talking about it on Sunrise, because Sammy's pretty popular in jail.
Sam Armitage.
Really?
Yeah, and Jane Bunn.
Really?
People love Jane Bunn.
I mean, I get it.
Universally, yeah.
Wow, I had no idea.
Wow,
those
okay.
two ladies.
Yeah, very.
Okay.
Yeah, Channel 7.
Right.
Good to know. I bet she'd be rapt to know
that. I'll pass that on, yeah.
But they were talking about, well, who even uses stamps anymore? And I was sitting there thinking, well, I do.
We do.
I use 10 a week, I reckon.
Who are you writing to, apart from you? Your kids, your parents?
Yeah, friends. I've got lots of cousins, and a lot of them wrote to me, and I'd write back. And it was great because it filled the time.
And also because it's pretty, sounds pretty lax security to me. It's got, yep, you know, no fence and stuff. But have you got internet? Have you got email? Have you got...
No, no. Right. So no one in prisons has internet.
Okay.
I studied while I was in there. And if you need to look something up on the internet, you go to the education officer, you make an appointment, you go and sit in their office, you tell them what you want to look up. They look it up on the computer with you looking at the screen.
Wow.
And you go, can I look at that website, please? And they look at that. Can I download that information, please? And you do that.
Oh, okay.
That's how you access the internet.
That would be punishment enough for me.
Yeah. Yeah,
to not be able to Google something when, yeah, I wanted to Google, to make an appointment for someone else to Google it.
Yeah, it'd be hard.
Way. It's, well, an absolute joy not having Facebook for a year.
I mean, I get that, but also it's very...
Digital detox.
Yeah, it's a digital detox, but it's also like... Surely that would be part of, particularly if you've done a long sentence, of the weirdness of getting out of jail, yeah, at the end when you're trying to come back into the real world.
That, yes, I think it would be. Mm. I think the guy I was talking about who did the murder and the manslaughter was struggling to thinking about what he was going to do. So, and it's my opinion that they don't handle getting you back into the society very well.
Mm-hmm. You know, like life moves so fast, doesn't it? Like, yeah, with technology and...
But I'm a reasonably intelligent sort of bloke, and I wasn't in there for a long time. But they don't, you know, like I said to you on day one, I said to them I wouldn't mind talking to someone, a psychologist or something. There is no psychological program at that jail.
That's shocking.
There certainly wasn't at the time that I was there.
That's shocking.
And a good third of the prison are on something like Lexapro or something like that for depression or anxiety, and there's no psychologist. On my second last day, the week before you leave, you go into all of these programs where they tick you off that you're healthy and they tick you off that what your medical records are and all that sort of stuff. So I had an appointment with a counsellor, sat down to talk to her, and I said, I assume this is part of me going home. And she goes, no, you requested this. So when did I request this? When you came. It's February. That was last May. And you're right, I did. Is this just the prison ticking off that they've done it so that they can say they've done it?
Yeah.
And I left, to be honest. I walked out. But
what if you, like, say, present as, you know, suicidal or homicidal? I mean, will they find you some help then?
Yeah, or you get moved.
You just get moved.
Or if you question stuff too much, I'll tell you a nice story. That stuff that I sent to Emily, I think I've written about 40,000 words. I've got a little thing here. Where is it? About asking questions. Because that's the dumbest thing you can do. And you can, and you can get sent to... another prison because you asked the wrong question, because you forgot where you were, basically, okay, right? The thing that I got told a number of times while I was there was that Beechworth is the best prison in the system. And that might be true, but the guards use that to justify why you wouldn't want to get moved.
Mm-hmm.
So is that okay if I...
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. So this collision between me and the system was because I made the foolish mistake of asking a question. Every Sunday morning after morning muster, we had a unit inspection. Essentially, the officers take on a role of parent and they check our rooms are tidy before we're allowed to go out and play. On this Sunday, the officers were searching for contraband. Contraband is the overarching term given to anything prisoners aren't allowed to have. From obvious things like drugs and weapons, USB drives and offensive magazines, to less obvious things like Vegemite, books and sleeveless T-shirts. Today, the contraband at the top of the list was cardboard boxes. Claiming fire hazard, the officers swept through our unit, dumping clothes on beds and confiscating cardboard boxes. The real reason these boxes get taken, which surprisingly I learned from the TV show America's Hardest Prisons, is that because cardboard is made up of layers of compressed paper that can be peeled apart and used for hiding things. But our officers didn't explain that. Their two statements were fire risk and we don't make the rules. Then I made my mistake. Why, I asked, is a single cardboard box under my bed a fire hazard when there are three full ring binders of schoolwork in my wardrobe that are not a fire hazard? If a bushfire came through here, you'd be dead, the officers replied, and I agreed that that was almost certainly true. I wasn't sure what that had to do with my cardboard box, though, so I checked. I agree, I said, but I'm not sure a cardboard box in my room will make the difference. I suspect I'll be dead because the fire hose out the front is padlocked and so are the breathing apparatus. But once again, why is my schoolwork not a fire hazard? I don't make the rules, I was told. I'd like to see the rules, I responded, completely forgetting for a moment where I was and that I was not supposed to argue. Maybe you could read the rules on the bus to Darringal, the officer asked. At this point, I had two options. One was to back off, take the officer's position as correct, and apologise. And I took the other one. Sorry, sir. Are you suggesting because I'm interested in the OH&S rules of the prison that I might be tipped? I was aware at this point I was being a smartass, but I was also aware I didn't want to stop just yet. Being tipped is being moved to another prison, and it's one of the very few threats that an officer has. On most prisoners, it has the desired effect of them backing off. Most crims will tell you once you've settled into a prison, it's easier to stay there than to learn how to be in a new one. I've never met a prisoner who's afraid to do it, but most can't be bothered, and that's why the threat works. No, the officer said, I'm suggesting you remember that you're in the best prison in the system and you back off and let us do our job. And at that point, I decided that was enough was probably more than enough, and so I stopped.
Tipped. And, yeah, I can completely understand why you wouldn't want to be moved.
Yeah.
You know, it seems like it does take a lot of settling in. So when you tell us about your life, trying to pull your life back together again after this, your release. What happened on release day? Like, who picked you up? How'd you get out of there?
My then wife picked me up. And left my son at home with Granny and came home, and I had some time with just him and her and my mum, and then two of my best mates came over, and my two best mates who had been the closest to me through the whole sort of process came over. I had a couple of beers. And I think probably early just got exhausted, and it was very, like, it was almost Pavlovian that at 4:30 I was looking around for where I had to line up, because you get there's four counts a day at Beechworth where you go and you line up and they count how many of you there are there, because there has been escapes from the recently.
I'm not surprised there's no fence.
Yeah. Yep. You're supposed to be very low risk, but yeah, that's right, there's no fence. So that was sort of the first day, and then I think the second day we went out for Yum Cha, which was, I got overwhelmed and we had to leave. Mm. It was just too people-y. And then my best mate, the guy who had helped me, the solicitor and everything, went away for 5 weeks, and I lived at his house, which is in Northcote. So I had my own space for that period of time. A couple of my friends actually owned a bar around the corner, so went around and went, oh, mate, we haven't seen you for ages. Where have you been?
You wouldn't believe it.
Prison.
Yeah.
Where have you been? No, actually. And that was a really precious time, just to be by myself, finding my feet.
So were you honest about everyone as to where you'd – honest with everyone as to where you'd been?
Yeah, to the point where it tripped me up trying to get a job.
Yeah. Right.
Because I came out going, my life has to be truth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This lying business, you know, you always get caught. You always get caught. And lying's only about protecting yourself. It's not, you know, it's about you not making yourself look like an idiot. It never works. You're just better off ripping the Band-Aid off that wound and telling the truth and letting it heal straight away. So I was really lucky that a friend of mine who I hadn't seen for years had got in touch with my sister and said, when he comes home, I've got a job for him.
Wow.
And it was an on-the-road sales job for his business. And then probably 2 months into that, he said, listen, we're not going as well as we thought we were, and we can't afford to keep you, so we can keep you for another 2 months. But, you know, and I will be grateful to him forever, because he gave me a kickstart, and it's easier to get a job when you've got one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I didn't have the conversation about it. But then when I found – so I applied for – a squillion jobs, and out of 5 interviews, I got 3 of the jobs, and at the last hurdle, I told them about the prison, and that was it. Done. Out. And then I sat down with my dad and said, I don't want to do about this. Like, I don't have to go and get a job digging ditches, and probably even then they're going to ask me if I've got a criminal record. And he said, Scott, don't ask, don't tell. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
If you go to an interview and they don't ask you, don't tell them, and tell them once you've settled in for a month. Give yourself a chance to prove yourself. You're an okay guy. And I was really lucky. So the next, a couple of interviews after that, I went for a job with the company I work for now, and they didn't ask, and I started working for them, and it was a 6-month probation. And about 4 months in, I sat down with my boss and said, "There's something I've got to tell you." They never asked this question. They do now. They never asked this question when I was interviewed.
Change of policy.
Yeah, that's right. But this is my story, and I've been away, and I've been to jail, and this is what happened, and da da da. And so he went, "Oh, right. I need to talk to the general manager." "Of course you do." "Yeah." So I had 24 hours of thinking, well, I'm going to have to start put my resume back together. And I got called into the general manager's office that next morning, sat down, and he said to me, "Righto, I believe you've made a bit of a mistake in your past." And I said, "Yeah, I have. You're right. What was it?" And I told him, and he goes, "Well, you know what? We're going to leave it in your past. How does that sound?"
Wow.
And I was sitting there going, "Don't cry, don't cry." Because he was an old school, you know, real tough guy, sort of great bloke. And he said, "You know, we are an industry that claim to care about people, and if we didn't care about you in this moment, we wouldn't be much of a business. So that's what we're going to do. If I ever find out that somebody's down talked to you about it in the company or made a decision against you in the company just because of this, they'll hear from me." And, you know, I work in a role now there where I got the authority to sign checks.
Wow.
So they really have gone.
They really mean it.
Mm-hmm.
You've had a good experience with forgiveness, I guess. Like what?
Amazing.
What would you say to anyone who's listening who has something going on in their lives that they're scared is going to come out? Doesn't even have to be a crime, but living with that thing that someone could find out at any moment. So terrifying.
I would say you control how it comes out. Tell someone. Just tell someone. My best mate, who was the one that helped me pay for the solicitor and did all that sort of stuff, if I had told him, you know, 6 months before, 3 months before, any time, we could have worked something out together. But I didn't tell him because I knew he wouldn't let me get away with it.
Mm.
So, you know, that bit where between where you tell someone and all the pain happens is what people are scared of.
Mm-hmm.
But it stops after that, you know. And I've got a great relationship with my son's mum now. I would say we're mates, you know, we're not together and that didn't work out okay. But I've got a great relationship with my son because I was honest with him about what was happening. And before I went in, we sat down and I told him what I'd done. And his first response was, "You probably should go to jail." And I said, "All right, well, that's a possibility." So we talked about it. And it's something that happened back then now. And it's because at some point it stopped. And I went through all of that hurt and all of that angst and all of that painful stuff. But, man. The sooner you do that, the better your life, you get your life back.
I always think the fear of things is generally worse than they actually are. Now you're in a position because what actually happened was pretty bad.
Yeah.
Do you reckon the fear of that painful period was worse than what it actually turned out to be?
Yeah, considerably.
Okay.
Yeah, considerably. I'm not afraid of jail or anything now.
No.
I wouldn't be afraid of going back.
Wow.
And in my job now, people say to me quite often, I'd say I'm in the funeral industry now, and there can be moments of really high stress, and I don't get stressed. And people who are sort of close to me, I've had a few people say to me, "You're just so calm in the face of something going wrong." And I said, "Yeah, but in my head I go, is this better or worse than being in jail?"
Yeah.
Guess what? Most things are
still
better.
Still better.
Yeah.
Guess you're not seeing someone stabbed over a mobile phone.
Yeah, that's right. You know, most things are better.
You seem as though you've come out changed, you know, genuinely changed a lifetime's behaviour for you.
Because of me, the sad thing about I came out with a much more negative view of how our prison system works. That, you know, like I said, there's no psychological assistance at that particular prison. I came out with the feeling that it's a deprivation of liberty. That's what it is. But a lot of the time it feels like they're trying to take away your pride and they're trying to take away your sense of self-worth and they're trying to make sure that you're the little man and whoever, you know, whatever officer it is you're talking to is the big man and and some at Beechworth was not bad. There was only one or two that were a bit like that. They were a bit sort of bullyish and that sort of thing.
What scares me about that is it feels like it would spit out worse people.
Yeah, at the end.
That's what's
demoralise you to the point where you kind of can't function properly.
Yeah, you're back in the community and you're angrier. And
the every time, like my heart sinks every time a crim does something while they're on parole because I was so lucky not to get parole. Parole is a bastard of a thing.
Is it?
It is so hard to keep. I had prison friends who went home and came back in the time that I was in because of parole. So one of them was part of his stipulation on his parole was he wasn't allowed to talk to his ex-wife directly. And that was because the breakup was part of the reason why he was in there. And then she called him one night about 3 weeks after he'd been out and said, the kids are sick. They're really sick. I have to work. Can you come and bring them to your place? And he said, I'm not meant to be talking to you. She said, I know, but this is the situation. He got put back in, not because she complained, because he was honest with his parole officer him that that's what how his week had been. How's your week been? Well, I had to talk to her and blah, blah, blah. What do you mean you talked to her? Well, I had to because the kids, bang, back in jail. And I get that parole's there to protect the community and it's a way to sort of slowly release people, but we're not doing it right. Mm. And we're not releasing people back into the community right. It's just, it's not right.
You can contact us just like Will did on our Australian True Crime Facebook page. Next week, we have another retired homicide detective to introduce to you because we know you love them as much as we do. In the meantime, if you like our show, please leave us a nice review and 5 stars on iTunes so more people can find us.